Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radio
from
WNYC.
See?
Yeah. Are you ready?
Okay.
Hey, I'm Jed Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today...
Well, we're defying odds.
Yeah, we're going to look at two people, two daring dudes, pushers of limits.
Two badasses, actually. Really.
Who are, yes, pioneers.
Hmm.
One in the air, and the other
on the ice.
Yeah. We're going to start off just for kicks in New York City, Harlem.
With, let's see.
I'm Paige Capote.
One.
Trinice Jones.
Two.
My name is Catherine Martin, and I go to school in CS200.
Three girls.
Doing a little jump rope chant.
Lincoln Beachy thought it was a dream to go up to heaven in a flying machine. The machine broke down, and down he fell. He thought he'd go to heaven, but he went to Lincoln Beachy thought it was a dream.
So this is a story, actually, about the guy at the center of this chant. The guy who's being jump roped about. Name's Lincoln Beachy, and he's...
Someone I heard about from a friend of mine.
Hello. My name is Sam Keen, and I'm a writer.
And then we met this guy.
Hey, hey. My name is Frank Marrero.
And together they told us the story of the most famous man you've never heard of.
Lincoln Beachy.
Can you tell? What can you tell us about Lincoln Beachy, the early years?
He was, you know, he was born here in San Francisco.
Kind of a short kid, sort of lonely, kind of chubby, emotional. You know, he wasn't exactly a popular kid, not someone you'd peg as a hero.
But
he was fearless.
For instance, when he was about 10, this would be 1897, he was really into
bicycles.
And apparently he would launch himself
off Fillmore Hill, which is, you know, if you've seen the streets of San Francisco and seen cars flying through the air, that's those kind of hills without brakes. You know,
because what he really wanted to do, even as a little kid, is he wanted to fly.
Yeah.
And when Lincoln was 18 years old, he met one of the pioneers of the dirigible.
And he got this young guy, Lincoln Beachy, to be his dirigible pilot.
And what is a dirigible?
It's a big floating sack of hot air. That's a basic idea.
Okay. Sim says you could steer this thing, sort of, because it was kind of an early blimp.
Yeah.
But for Beachy,
just wasn't enough.
He wanted to fly in a plane. Planes were the future.
Keep in mind, this was early 1900s.
Less than 10 years after the Wright brothers flew their first flight.
Planes were pretty primitive.
Basically like a flying bicycle.
Even so, people were getting really excited about aviation, so they were going to air shows.
They had every kind of flying machine that did and didn't work.
And Beachy, he tracked down the guy who put together most of the really big air shows.
He says, hey, you know, I'm Lincoln Beachy. You know, I'm like, you know, really popular and cool and everything, and I'll be glad to fly for you. And he said, no, I don't think so. We don't need another pilot.
But Beachy says,
how about, do you need a good mechanic? And so he got on as a mechanic.
I have heard stories that he would sleep in a tent near the plane factory, and he would actually get up at dawn and sort of sneak into these planes so he could fly them before other people were around.
And his big break came at a show in LA when one of the big-time show pilots goes up, gets injured, and the organizer's like,
who are we going to get to show the rest of the planes? And Beachy says, oh, I'll do it.
Bum-ba-da-dum.
So they sent poor Beachy up in this plane, and he got up to about 3,000 feet, and the motor stopped.
Stopped? Now,
like just
stopped.
So there he is, 3,000 feet in the air, and
the plane starts to drop.
Down, down,
and it's not
down,
just dropping, it's
spinning. No one has ever gotten out of this. In 1910, one in three flights ended in disaster.
Because whenever this happened, the pilot would try to do sensible things like turn the plane the opposite direction.
It makes it worse.
Or try to pull up.
Makes it way worse.
But Lincoln Beachy, in a split second, decides to do something
totally odd.
He realized what he was going to have to do is dive into it.
In other words, turn into the spin and down.
He came right out of it.
Wait, he came right out of it. I mean, he landed the plane?
Yeah, when you dive into the spin, when you do the absolute worst thing you can think of, then all the controls come back.
So suddenly the plane just stopped spinning and he was able to land?
Yeah, he just curls out of it, pulls out of it, and lands and floats it down. And he said, I suddenly could feel the airplane.
As though it was part of his body.
And from that moment forward, aviation was never the same. He went bananas. When you go see an aerobatic show and you see them do all these fancy this's and that's, he invented them. The figure eight, the vertical drop, the dip of death. He was the first person to point his plane straight down and achieve terminal velocity. At the time, medical science said if you achieve terminal velocity, you would die from fear. He would dive out of the sky from thousands of feet, spinning at the ground, and at the last second, pull up and pick up a handkerchief with his wingtip.
No.
Oh, yes.
Way.
Oh, yes. He invented aerobatics.
Pick up a handkerchief and with his wingtip? From where? The ground?
Yeah.
That's crap. There's no way.
Wait a second.
Well, we may never know for sure because these things are wrapped within legends.
Clearly.
But a lot of people saw wonderful things happen.
Everybody recognized that this was nascent. This was new. The population in the United States was about 90 million then. 17 million people saw him that one year alone.
He was a pretty big deal.
He had a girlfriend in every major American city. I talked to people who watched him buy diamond engagement rings by the dozens. And he always had one in his vest pocket.
Thomas Edison praised him. Carl Sandburg wrote a poem about him.
Railroads changed their schedules to follow him around the country.
What?
Orville Wright called him the most wonderful aviator anyone has ever seen.
People are gaga.
And most gaga of all are pilots.
So many people are dying imitating him. The city of San Diego considered doing a legal injunction to bar him from flying.
But for Beachy, nothing could stop him, for a while at least. Nothing could stop him until he mastered this one particular trick, the trick of all tricks.
Loop the loop.
Yeah.
What is that?
Basically, it's like exactly like a roller coaster, where you go level, then you go upside down, you come back going the same way. Difficult thing to do. Humans aren't evolved to fly. It's very easy to lose your equilibrium, to get screwed up on what's up, what's down.
Still, Beachy thinks, I'm going to do this thing.
Can't stop me.
But one day he's on a train.
He's going to speak at the Olympic Club. And Charlie Walsh's wife. Now, Charlie Walsh is one of his dear friends. He had just died 2 days before trying to do a Beachy, as dozens did.
Meaning trying to...
Do a trick that Beachy did. It's called doing a Beachy.
Right.
And so Charlie Walsh's wife sees him changing trains and she crashes against him saying, you killed Charlie. He's in the baggage car in a coffin.
It really got to him.
And it started him thinking about all the people who had died trying to imitate him.
At one point he said he felt like he had murdered some of these people. That's how hard he took this. And at that point, he decided he couldn't go on with it. He decided he had to retire.
So he arrives at the Olympic Club, and as everyone's cheering, steps up to the podium.
Comes up and says, you could not make me enter a plane again at the point of a revolver. I'm done.
That's really what he said?
That's really what he said.
Wow.
But he added a kind of parting thought.
I am tormented with the desire to loop the loop in the air. I know I can do it, but I know no one else can do it. And I know that if I ever go up into the air again, I will pull off this loop-the-loop, and then many men will be taken by death in trying to do the same thing because I have done it.
So he retires for 3 months, and...
That's not exactly quitting.
Here's the thing. During those 3 months, the unthinkable happens. Somebody else does the loop-the-loop for the first time. Some Frenchman.
He couldn't stand that someone else had looped the loop before him, and he decided he was going to be the best looper in the world. And it took him a few months of practice.
But he did it.
He eventually outdid the Frenchman, and he would start pulling, four, five, six loops in a row.
Again and again and again and again.
When he finally did the loop-de-loop, I want to read you what he wrote. the silent reaper of souls, and I shook hands that day.
Thousands of times, we have engaged in a race among the clouds, plunging headlong into breathless flight, diving and circling with awful speed through ethereal space. And many times when the dazzling sunlight has blinded my eyes and sudden darkness has numbed all my senses, I have imagined him close at my heels. On such occasions, I have defied him, but in so doing have experienced fright which I cannot explain. Today, the old fellow and I are pals.
Suffer me for a second while I wax philosophical.
Do it.
Something happened in the psyche of humanity. You got to realize, for 100,000 years, millions upon millions of people have wanted to fly.
And Frank believes that when people saw Beachy loop the loop so many times, so effortlessly, it was a turning point.
If you could do that, you were free in the air.
We were no longer just managing to fly. Now, we own the sky.
1915. The World's Fair is going to be held that year in San Francisco, California, which is Beachy's hometown.
Now, at the time, he was working on a monoplane, a single-wing airplane.
It was a brand new thing. It hadn't been tested.
But the fair officials had seen it, and they said, oh, would you fly us your new one? He said, sure.
So?
March 14th.
Beachy takes this thing up for its very first flight.
Some people say there are up to 250,000 people at the expo, and most of them were watching him.
So he goes up above over Alcatraz and 3,000 feet above Alcatraz and starts diving. And that structural, metallurgical smarts hadn't been developed enough yet on single-wing airplanes, and both of his wings cracked back.
Someone said it sounded like a ship mast just snapping, cracking right in half.
He fell 3,000 feet. They estimated him going at 250 miles an hour and hit the water right at the foot of Fillmore Hill.
When a doctor looked at him later, he actually only had a broken leg from the impact. But what got him was he was strapped in pretty tightly, and no matter how hard he struggled, he could not get out of the straps. Huh. Plane had him wrapped in so tightly, it just drug him down to the bottom, and he drowned in the bottom of San Francisco Bay.
After that show,
for 24 hours straight,
you couldn't make a phone call in San Francisco.
Because so many people were calling in and out with news and rumors about what had happened to Lincoln Beachy. So he took down the entire San Francisco phone system.
So why has he been erased from the common historical memory? I mean, you hear about flying aces from World War I, Eddie Rickenbacker, mm-hmm. and you hear about Charles Lindbergh, of course, and you hear about
Amelia Earhart.
Yeah, but you don't hear about Lincoln Beachy.
Well, after the war, we had new heroes. And he slipped into obscurity.
Except for one thing.
It's a jump rope chant.
One, two, three, four.
Lincoln Beachy thought it was a dream.
That, you know, little kids would say.
The machine broke down, and down he fell. He thought he'd go to heaven, but he went to...
It went, Lincoln Beachy thought it was a dream to go up to heaven in a flying machine. The machine broke down, and down he fell. Instead of going to heaven, he went to...
Lincoln Beachy thought it was a dream to go up to heaven in a flying machine. The machine broke down, and down he fell. He thought he'd go to heaven, but he went to... Lincoln Beachy thought it was a dream to go up to heaven in a flying machine. The machine broke down and down he fell. He thought he'd go to heaven, but he went to Lincoln Beachy thought it was a dream to go up to heaven in a flying machine. The machine broke down and down he fell. He thought he'd go to heaven, but he went to Lincoln Beachy thought it was a dream to go up to heaven in a flying machine. The machine broke down and down he fell. He thought he'd go to heaven, but he went to Lincoln Beachy.
Thanks to Sam Keen, author of The Disappearing Spoon and other true tales of madness, love, and the history of the world, from the periodic table of elements. And thanks to Frank Moreno.
Morero?
Right.
My book is Lincoln Beachy, The Man Who Owned the Sky.
And thanks to Nick Capodici for being our Lincoln Beachy.
And lastly, we want to thank again our jump ropers at CS200 here in Manhattan and this talented group of singers at the LaGuardia School of the Arts.
My name is Emma Moorcroft.
Kelly F. Thumiu.
Julia Egan.
Mariel Nazareno.
Ruby Froome.
And Ruby wrote and arranged what you're hearing.
Lincoln Beachy thought it was a dream to go up to heaven in a flying machine. The machine broke down and down he fell. He thought he'd go to heaven, but he went to...
Oh, and thank you to Robert Apostle at LaGuardia and Brenda Addison at CS200. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Klobuch.
Coming up, we meet another daring doer who also defies gravity and the rules of the game.
But this time not in the air.
No.
No, it's sort of in the air, but mostly, mainly, really, it's on the ice.
Sort of like in that airspace just above the ice.
Well, the liminal space between the ice, the moisture, and the frozen part is the zone I like to call...
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's where we're going to go. We're going to go.
This is Alicia Bridges calling from Saskatoon in Saskatchewan. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café, s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so then, what? How are we going to introduce this? How would you convince the many people listening to
Wouldn't
stay
it work?
Listening?
Because it's a great story. It doesn't matter that it's figure skating. It's like a really good story. It's a good story that like pops off of. It's like
okay. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. And look, I've never been a huge fan of figure skating, but like this story, I think asks a really interesting question.
The question would be: what if you, with all your heart, wanted to be the very, very best at something? Lincoln Beachy, in the last segment, he was arguably the best aerobatic pilot of his time. He was recognized as being the best. But what happens if the people who judge what's best at whatever it is you want to do don't share their bestness with your sense of bestness, so you do your best and their best and your best are different and now you can't best it out?
What do you do?
What do you do?
Story comes from our producer, Latif Nasser, and also producer, Tracy Hunt.
Okay.
All right. Okay, so let's start then. So we're starting in 1998. We're at the Olympics in Nagano.
In Japan.
And
on the ice. So we've seen the girl.
Warming up on the ice, you have this woman, this figure skater. Saria Bonnelly.
How do you spell Saria?
S-U-R-Y-A. She's French, 24 years old. She's black.
Was 5 times European champion, but all sorts of problems, particularly injury problems.
She's got an Achilles tendon that's been stitched together.
Pulled a muscle.
She's on painkillers. And
she competed for France in 1994 and just missed the podium.
She's never medaled at the Olympics before. This is her, probably her last go. In front of the world.
For France, here is Saria Bonnelly.
And it was during this performance that Saria Bonnelly did something that had never been done by anyone.
Anyone. Ever.
And you could either see it as a kind of
middle finger to the establishment, like this huge F you.
Or...
Oh my goodness.
Oh. Hello.
Just this beautiful moment of self-affirmation.
What did she do?
We'll get there.
Hello?
Hello!
Hi.
How are you doing?
Pretty good, thanks.
I laughed out loud when I heard you say that you would call me on your Zamboni break.
Yeah. I know, I was like, it's the only time. And I guess
okay, so to really understand like, just the context of all of this and the stakes of that moment, we got to go all the way back. So... How did you first get into skating?
Well, I did start skating because of my mom, actually.
So Saria was actually adopted as a baby by this white couple in the south of France. She grew up in Nice.
My mom was a sport coach, and she was able to be like a volunteer for a gymnastic club and skating club. So even though, you know, I was small, tiny, she just put me on the ice and say, hey, just hang around and chill on the ice. And, you know, and I spent lots of hours there just waiting for my mom. And one day I find out that I had, you know, some skating boots who fit me. And
she started skating.
Yeah. Fortunately, I was good at it.
Pretty soon. She had a coach.
From the local ring, I guess a coach kind of call and have a meeting with your parents, say, hey, you know, it would be nice if you could come like 2 times a week. Mm-hmm. Probably now it would be nice if we'll do maybe 4 times a week. Well, how about every day? I was like, oh, okay. Here we go.
And so by the age of 10, she decides she wants to spend her life figure skating.
It was my dream to, you know, to do it, and I know I can.
So she would go to these ice shows.
Like Holiday on Ice. So when I see the show, I love the bling bling. I love the showtime and just, you know, those fantastic costumes.
She would see all these famous skaters.
I had my eyes glued on those skaters.
They would just be flying through the air.
I thought it was like amazing.
And she would go to practice and she would practice all of the things she saw, all the double axles and the triple toe loops.
And split jumps.
And the sow cows and the double sow cows and the, you know, quadruple double triple axles.
Do you have any idea what you're saying right now?
No. These are all just words to me.
It was very fast. I improve like every week, every month, you can see a difference.
And speaking of difference, you know, if we fast forward a little bit.
And here she is on the world stage, Saria Bonnelly.
In 1989, when she appears at the World Championships.
The thing that becomes really apparent is that she is different.
Yeah, because I was black. So I was like, people were like, what? French, black.
So I'm black and... I definitely remember when she was about to skate, my mom would be like, the black girl is skating. So we all had to like pay attention.
And so people start to be kind of curious.
This girl is very different.
Well, it was arresting.
That's Johnette Howard,
senior writer for ESPN.com.
Saria Bonnelly is a striking and exotic figure on the ice.
She just arrested your eyes when she skated. The contrast of her skin on the ice was beautiful. And then there were these fanciful stories that sprung up about where she came from.
We are now taking you about as far away from the skating world as possible.
Pretty much as soon as she hit the scene, you started hearing these rumors that she had been adopted from a coconut-strewn beach in Reunion Island off the coast of Madagascar.
An unlikely place to find a world-class figure skater.
And that she had, that she, what was it?
Notice her hair.
That she never cut her hair.
Saria has not cut her hair since
her birth.
That she existed on a diet of bird seed and, you know, all these things.
Yeah.
I mean, like the idea like she's some kind of black forest princess or something.
Exactly.
Exactly,
yeah.
Yes. Saria says, you know, at that age, she really didn't know too much about what was going on.
You know, as a kid, I was like, whatever, my coach deal it. You know, he's the one who speaks English.
She could barely speak English. She was barely 16.
Yeah, she was still a young baby.
I did talk to the guy who was coaching her at the time, this guy named Didier Gayage, and he told me he planted these stories.
We use the press very well.
Wait, what?
He said that he made up the beach thing. He made up the hair thing because he was trying to. She was a star.
And what do we want to hear? Stories, right? So we made some stories, some good ones. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I'm just saying that we're making up stories because you want to hear them.
That is just creeped out.
Yeah, you're absolutely weird. Right. It's shady as f***. But I can kind of see where he was going, because what he was trying to do was that he was trying to present her to the world as this, like, radically new kind of skater.
Because the female skating at that moment were nice, cute girls.
Especially for ladies, they like to keep the girls pretty.
Flowers for Katarina.
Those famous skaters like Katarina Witt.
The ravishing Katarina Witt.
Oh.
Look, there's Sonia Henny.
Sonia Henny. They were like totally like women, you know, pretty, graceful, who makes those men, you know, crazy when they were watching it, you know.
They were also
white. How would I say? They had a certain conception of female skating. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the same one.
And it wasn't just that she looked different, she also skated differently.
It was a totally different approach. Saria was always very, like, explosive.
Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis Stoiko is in the building.
Three-time world figure skating champion.
Met Saria Juniors 1990.
For me, it was sort of a new face on the scene.
And here's the,
like, the fresh stick of gum.
Tiny 15-year-old French girl who's captured everyone's imagination here.
Like, say, a Tanya Harding-style skating.
She was just so exciting, and there was just no boundaries for her.
This is Tanya Harding. Mm-hmm. And she and Saria were friends.
The strength and the power.
She'd step on the ice and people would go crazy.
Saria Bonaly.
She'd strike a pose and then just take off.
Saria would go from one end to the other.
Good speed across the ice.
Flying across the rink.
With powerful stroking.
Her opening, a triple S and a triple toe.
She'd come hurling into these jumps.
Triple S!
Soaring through the air.
Triple toe!
With powerful spin.
Wow. And she'd do jump after jump.
That really was a corker.
She really is amazing.
Combination after combination.
Another triple flip.
I prefer to hit a triple jump than just to do a pretty spready goal.
And she would attack everything.
That's a very fast step sequence.
She had the stepping, the gliding, the running. She had it all.
What a talent. And the crowd here appreciate it. With such jumping ability, and there's no end to what she might achieve.
Outside of competition, she would do these ice shows and exhibitions, and that's when you would see, like, what she can really do.
She would just do all kinds of other jumps that weren't even allowed in competition.
She would do backflips. She would do handsprings. Yes, backflips.
The very first time that I ever saw her do a backflip, I mean, my mouth just dropped open.
That's Tanya Harding again.
I was like, how did you do that?
Because it's really dangerous. Elvis Stoiko told us that one time he tried it and it did not go well.
I came down right on my face and I split my eye open and almost broke my neck. And I was just like, you know what? I don't think this is going to be a good thing.
Oh, no. But this little teenage girl, Saria Bonaly, no problem. Just doing it. Like, it
yeah,
was nothing.
She was just absolutely fearless. And the crowd loved it.
People, like, when they stand up and start making noise and tap their feet into the ground. I can feel like the whole building. I'm like, I swear, it looks like an earthquake.
But here's what happened, and this is where things kind of get confusing. As Saria blows up and all these people who never liked figure skating fall in love with her over and over.
The judges don't. Artistic impression.
And you can see disparity from the judges of 5-7. Well,
and the crowd do not like the marks.
Upset, no doubt. Even with the
so,
deduction.
She doesn't get high scores?
No.
Tears begin to flow.
It happened all the time. I skate good, but somehow it's not for me.
And it's second place for Saria.
Saria So the judging system in figure skating goes from 0 to 6. And on Saria's artistic marks, she would get scores like 5 zeros, 5 ones.
Yeah, you get your low fives, which like sounds like it's a good mark, but that's not a good mark.
Saria, what did you think of those marks?
Oh, never mind. It's okay.
Very, very disappointed. You were really terrific.
Never mind. That's life. I'm used to it.
What'd she say there?
She said, never mind. That's life. I'm used to it.
I thought, it's still sport. Sports mean challenge. Every day I try to do the best that I could do. You do your best. It's fine.
But clearly there were some times where I got to her. There was this one time we found on YouTube where she boos the judges.
What?
After she gets her score.
The whole crowd is booing.
Wait, so why was she getting bad marks to begin with? What was the problem?
Well, that's the question, and it's kind of complicated.
Yeah, well, I think there's several things.
Jonette Howard, that ESPN writer,
yep.
She says the first thing you got to know is that there's this fundamental tension in the sport of figure skating between artistry on one side and athleticism on the other.
Powerfulness versus prettiness.
They want these people to look like little ballerinas but leap into these jumps like predators. And at the time, skating was sort of locked in this loud and fractious debate about what do we want to be? And Saria was sort of the epitome of almost the end point. What could happen if somebody with unrivaled athleticism and no aversion to risk was willing to go after it? And I think there were a lot of people in skating that didn't want it.
I went through it. I know all about it.
Now, Tanya Harding, she said that she had this issue.
I didn't want to skate like what they wanted skating to look like.
Elvis Stoiko, too. But in Saria's case,
there's a lot of work to be done on the choreography yet. There's a lot of work to be done on the grace.
All those words used to criticize her skating.
There's a lot there to be fixed.
I'd like to see her stop jumping for 6 months and learn to skate.
We're just a little bit more loaded.
They would say things like, oh,
raw talent there.
You know, there's this a lot of raw talent, but it's not, hasn't been refined. And it's, for us, like non-skaters, like that's been one of the challenges of this story, I guess, is like trying to see, like, is that a legit criticism?
Or is this just a way of saying that she's black?
It was racism. I have the courage to say it because she was black.
So this is Marie-Reine Lagunia, and she is a former French figure skating official. And she was part of a team whose job it was to decide which girls to send to the World Junior Championships.
And we have to choose only two girls, and we had three possibilities.
She said that she backed Saria.
And the majority of the people didn't want black skaters.
Were they saying it out loud? Look, we don't want somebody, we don't want her because she's black?
No, or was it was very subtle, in fact.
According to her, what they would say, they would say the kind of things like, she was too muscular or she wasn't elegant enough.
Oh, yes, I have to say that word, elegant. Many times I have heard that word. She's not elegant.
Marie Ren is an outsider in the figure skating world these days because of an unrelated scandal. And so we weren't totally sure what to think about that. But
wait, how did Saria feel about all this?
Well, I asked her. Did you feel like any of the difficulty was because you're black?
No.
Did you feel like any of it was about race? No?
No.
But then moments later, she said,
well, you know, when you're black, you know, everybody knows that you have to do better than anybody else who's white.
Well, I think the idea that she was held back in her marks for any other reason other than the quality of her skating, I think, is incorrect.
That's Sandra Bezek.
I've been involved in the skating world my whole life as a competitor, as an Olympian, a commentator.
And actually as a commentator?
I'd like to see her stop jumping for 6 months and learn to skate.
She was kind of hard on Saria.
Yes.
And when we asked her why, this is what she said.
Everything about skating is built on circles. The radius could be huge, but it's still a circle. Everything is about edges and leaning into those edges and leaning into the turns and carving massive circles on the ice. And that is our sport, which leads to Saria. I mean, if you watch her jumps, they were on straight lines. And if a jump is on a straight line, then it can't land with flow. Because the idea is to land your jump with as much speed and flow as you had going into it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that she couldn't do because she was jumping on straight lines. And then the other thing about skating that you don't necessarily get on camera is the sound of the edge. The sound of a beautiful skater going from edge to edge, from lean to lean.
What does that sound like?
It's a beautiful sound. It's a sound that we all love. It's a gentle carving.
The image, the sound I have in my head is like a hockey stop, but that's probably not the sound.
Because there are no scratches. Mm. It's a glide. It's a hum. I wish I had a good word to describe it. I haven't got a good word for it. Damn.
So when Surya was skating, would she have that sound?
No. She would be scratchy.
Now, we should say that wasn't the sound of Surya skating. We just, mic'd up a whole bunch of, pretty good figure skaters.
Were they professional skaters?
Yeah. These are legit skaters.
They're professional figure skaters. And we sent the clip to Sandra, and she was like, yes.
So she gave you the thumbs up that we got it right.
Yep.
But see, I don't necessarily hear whatever it is she is hearing and think yes. I mean, they sound different, but not even that different, really.
So that's exactly the problem. Ice skating is largely about aesthetics. So as far as sports go, it's like kind of in its own category. Like if you're talking about Serena Williams, who's facing a lot of these same kinds of criticisms, it doesn't matter. There's a line on a court, and it's either inside or outside. There are rules, whereas there aren't these rules when it comes to beauty. It's super slushy, and that makes someone like Surya much more vulnerable.
So what ended up happening?
Well, after a couple of years of getting these kinds of marks, she does some soul searching.
I mean, I was a bit more mature.
In 1992, at the age of 18,
I had new changed my whole skating world. I changed coaches.
And she decides to take the note. She actually travels to California and works with Frank Carroll, who's like this legendary American coach. And what she's doing is that she's trying to, be more graceful, more beautiful, more elegant.
More circly.
More circly, yeah. And after that, you kind of see a difference.
Yeah, you can watch the YouTube videos from that period, and it's like she's a different skater.
Huh.
Yeah.
Does it work?
Yeah. In 1993, in the World Championships, she comes in second.
Oh.
And then by the time 1994 rolls around, she is a favorite. She is probably going to win.
And what happens?
Things take a really strange turn.
We'll be back right after the Samboni break.
Hi there, this is Kirsten recording from Orlando, Florida. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now, you're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café, s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year.
here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This is Radiolab. Let's get back to our story about Saria Bonaly, or Bonaly, as it's said in French, from producers Tracy Hunt and Latif Nasser.
I'm really curious what happened at that medal ceremony in 1994.
It was the World Championships.
That was the World Championships, Olympics. Yeah.
Not the Olympics. No. Yeah. Well, we had this World Championship in Japan.
7 Olympic titles, 17 World Championships.
Just to set this up, the World Championships are the second most important event in figure skating after the Olympics.
And at the Olympics, which were just a month before, the top three ladies.
16-year-old Oksana Bayul.
Oksana Bayul got gold.
Nancy Kerrigan is physically
Nancy Kerrigan got silver. Chen Lu got the bronze. In fourth place was Saria. Now, those top three ladies, Oksana, Nancy, Lu.
Out of the picture.
Out of the picture. For
why?
Various reasons.
Injuries and some turn pro and stuff, but whatever.
Okay.
The point is, at these World Championships, the highway had been cleared for Saria. She was going to take it. It was hers for the taking.
This is her winning season. Will it be gold?
So jumping forward to the final day of the championship, Saria is in second place. She takes the ice.
20 years old from Nice in the south of France.
Starts her program.
Immediately starts with this double axel.
That's very incredible.
After that is just triple.
On that landing, but still she's here for business.
It was just one of the best skates of her life.
I knew I did my best. I did everything. It was not perfect because nobody is perfect, but pretty good competition overall.
Eventually, after about 4.5 minutes, she finishes her skate.
Saria Bonaly to Vivaldi's four seasons. Loads and loads of technical difficulty. The question is, how will they see her artistic effort?
And she goes over off to the side to a bench with her coach to await her results.
Her technical merit. And some 5.9s that please her.
5.9.
Those are as high as any we've seen.
When she gets her marks, she jumps into first place, and there's only one skater left. It's a skater who usually finishes below Saria in competitions.
Yuka Sato.
Again, that's Sandra Bezek.
We all know Yuka's skating.
She's the kind of skater that puts a smile on your face.
Yuka was, you know, one of these really lyrical skaters.
Making his return, Elvis Stoiko.
And Yuka had this very
gorgeous,
beautiful
style and grace
to her skating.
This gentle, almost soundless quality, like a whisper across the ice.
Basically, her skating style was the exact opposite end of the spectrum from Saria's.
Sato, the 21-year-old from Tokyo.
So she gets up, does her final skate in front of the home crowd.
Yuka is one of my favorite skaters, but she doesn't have the combination jumps like Bonaly did, so she's going to need all her jumps, opening up with her triple X.
And she hits her first jump. Crowd loves it.
She did good. She had maybe less triples than me, but she was maybe more prettier.
In her routine, there were these moments where it just looks like she was just sort of skipping across the ice. Just very balletic moves.
I know, she's good, you know.
Backhand is one here at Makuhari Event Center for the local favorite, Yuka Sato. Now it's down to the judges as to whether the gold medal belongs to Sato of Japan or Bonaly of France.
So Yuka, you know, gets off the ice. She goes to wait for her marks.
First marks, of course, for technical merit, Bonaly's strength. Although Sato skated and jumped so well. And every one of those marks, except the finish judge, go to Bonaly. She wins 8 out of 9 technical merit.
But when it came down to the artistic marks,
just the opposite than the technical marks. 8 out of 9 judges, all but the French judge, giving her higher marks.
Those go to Yuka Sato.
Boy, this is going to be close.
It actually ends up being a tie.
So it goes to being a tiebreaker.
And that's when the judges basically pick first, second, and third. And in a 5-4 decision...
Artistic impression.
There it is! She's got it!
5-4, Sato is the new world champion.
Unfortunately, they choose her.
Off to the dressing room for the new champion. She'll be back, and so will we for the medal ceremonies.
What happens next is one of these moments that really defines Saria's story for a lot of people.
Right after all the results were out, they set up the medal ceremony. They called out the skaters. They first called out Yuka.
What a moment.
Waves, smiles at everybody. And then, after about a minute,
and now the silver medalist.
They called out Surya.
Surya Bonaly.
But...
And where is the European champion? All the cameras crowding around and...
She didn't come out.
Not immediately.
A late arrival, and here she comes.
She skates out onto the ice. She waves, but her face isn't smiling.
No.
And then when she gets to the podium, she congratulates Yuka Sato, but then...
Well, Bonaly has chosen not to stand on the podium.
She just stopped before getting on the podium. She just stood right next to the podium.
I think this is a form of protest.
I really hope she doesn't go through with this.
She wouldn't stand on it. She was crying.
Elvis actually was in the crowd watching.
I felt bad for her because I know what she was going through, where you know you outskated your competitor and they just wouldn't give it to you. And I was like, Saria, just get on the podium, take the medal.
The International Skating Union president, Olaf Paulsen.
The figure skating official who's giving out the medals, he gives Yuka the gold, puts it around her neck. But then when he turns to Saria, he just sort of stands there, looks at her. He says something, but you can't hear what it is. She shakes her head.
He puts the medal around Saria's neck, shakes her hand, and then he holds onto her hand and just kind of like pulls her onto the podium.
Well, this is a first for me, that's for sure.
Just heartbroken. Oh, and she takes off the medal.
She takes the silver medal off of her head.
Like, oh my God, holy she's actually doing this? It was huge. It was a huge deal.
The camera zooms in on her face and she is just weeping.
Oh, what's going on inside that young woman?
So after the medal ceremony is over, she just gets mobbed by reporters.
Saria,
why did you not accept the medal? What was the problem?
Because it's not my place and I'm just disappointed.
So you have
Are they unfair to you, Saria?
What?
Are the judges unfair to you?
It's a lie. Do you
feel you were robbed tonight? Is that what you're saying?
Did you deserve the gold medal, Saria?
And eventually what she says is...
I don't know. I'm just not lucky.
I'm just not lucky.
What was going on? Like, what happened?
I think it was more like a point of saying, this is it, stop now. You know, when you put your fist on a table and say, okay, now, enough is enough. That's it. I'm not dumb and I'm getting sick now. I'm sick of it. I keep my eyes open. That is not fair. That has to stop. And it was just so depressing and it was so not fair.
What about it felt unfair?
Just that, you know, happened over and over so many times that every time it's never me because whatever, I can do how many triple, I can be pretty, I can have the best choreographer, so everything was made to be on the top. And still, right. I'm like, what do you need more me to do at this point? You know, how many triple you want me? If I don't do, you kill me. And if I do, you don't care. And anyway, you choose somebody else.
Don't wow. you think that that's a little unsportsmanlike?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely.
Yeah, but if she...
You know, all these other girls have worked just as hard as she has, one presumes.
Sure, but okay, so picture yourself if you're at that position, you're in that position, you find yourself getting second, you feel like you're not...
She came in second, that's
it was
okay.
So, the margin was so close. It was so close.
It's always close.
Yeah, I think...
Can I...
Like, yeah, go.
I
I just more like felt empathy for her. I can't imagine what it must be like. Well, I can imagine what it must be like. But I, you know, in that kind, on that scale, to be the only one. And there is this, I think for, you know, a friend of mine once told me that racism can make black people crazy. Which is very a very broad way of looking at it, in the sense that you kind of almost never know why people are reacting to you the way that they do. And it's kind of, you're always sort of second guessing, you know, was that, you know, did they, oh, you know, that guy just came in and he said hi to everybody in the room, but he did say it to me. What was that about? And so there's no obvious thing about it, but it can make you feel a little paranoid, a little crazy. Now, I can't imagine how, you know, Saria felt in that moment. But I didn't necessarily, like, think that, you know, these prejudiced people had denied her this. If anything, I felt more like, man, it really must suck to be the only black woman skating at that kind of level and not really understand why things are happening. Or maybe it must be like a very confusing situation to be in. And that is, and it was more like empathy. I don't know, you know, if there was racism. Quite frankly, Yuka Sato is an amazing skater.
And I think you're right. It's very legitimate to feel like you can't put your finger on this feeling, which never goes away.
No.
And never resolves and is always there and always makes you feel weird.
What happens after the...
That's our producer, Matt Keelty.
After the ceremony.
I think the rep that she got after this moment was that she was a sore loser and that she was defiant, that she had a bad attitude.
And does she quit at this point? Or
no, she keeps going.
She competed again in the World Championships in 1995, the very next year, and she came in second.
Again. So 3 years in a row.
In a similar pattern? Was there like just one sort of...
That one wasn't as close yeah. but she was second again for the third year.
Did she skate a lot of other competitions after 95?
I think
she
did.
The various, you know, European Championships, you know, Skate America, so a bunch
of
them.
Yeah, she was doing a lot.
She never wins?
Not at the Olympics, not at the World Championships, no.
So she never gets first? What?
I guess it depends on how you define first.
What do you mean?
Well, you'll see. So that actually takes us right back to the beginning.
We're here live at 10 a.m. on Saturday morning in Japan.
So to jump forward, but rewind, we're in Nagano, Japan, 1998 Winter Olympics.
I knew it was my last Olympics and last major, major big competition. And everything was fine until the day before the short program. I pulled a muscle.
Her left leg.
And I couldn't lift, I couldn't do anything.
To make matters worse, Saria at that moment was already recovering from a ruptured Achilles tendon.
People had to carry me to walk stairs because I couldn't get stairs, so they'd have to lift me to go to my room because, you know, at the Olympic Village, I couldn't walk. You know, even I'm broken, I'm damaged, I'm like a used car that's really good for, like, you know, for trash. I'm like, you know, really, I was so messed up between my legs and my Achilles, I was like, oh, it's a disaster. And the doctor say, maybe we should withdraw. I'm like, no, I'm already here. You know, I don't want to just maybe retire. It's probably my last competition. I don't want to just retire like that. Just give me anything you can. I have to keep going.
And so on the final day,
she says that she, you know, between
medicine, massage, acupuncture, pills,
she goes back out on the ice
and is now getting ready to skate for her country.
She's in this golden blue sequined outfit, and she starts her routine. You can tell she's favoring one leg, but she manages to land a few jumps.
Didn't work for the Salco.
Then she falls.
She gets back up, keeps going through her routine.
There's the triple Salco.
And then she says she just got to this point where she just knew she couldn't do it.
It was so much in pain. And towards the end of the program, I was supposed to go for two more triple. And I said, you know what? I'm not good. I don't feel it. I know I'm going to crash. I can't do it. I'm not capable. My leg is not with me anymore.
And then what comes to her is that there is this move that she has in her repertoire that she can do, but it's illegal.
I had a special thing in my backpack and say, hey, I can do it. It's my last competition.
Was this all going through your mind as you were skating?
Yeah, oh yeah, totally. You know, me, it's like a computer. You know, if I would have missed something or jump, I'll say, okay, here, I can fit a triple here. Over there, I can do a combo, triple, triple. I know I need to fit something.
You're like the GPS lady. You're like recalculating.
Yeah, totally. Rerouting. Okay, redo. We have to do right now.
So in her rerouting, she turns around from skating forwards to skating backwards, picks up speed just like she's about to do a triple, but instead...
she does a backflip.
But not any old backflip.
She swings one leg over.
Does the splits in the air.
Upside down?
Yeah.
And then she lands on one foot.
Oh, my goodness.
Wait a second, when you do the backflip, do your skates go up towards the ceiling and then come back down underneath you again?
Yes.
It's a backflip.
Why was it illegal?
Well, it's illegal because it's so dangerous. Also, she says you're supposed to land all your jumps on one foot, but she did that here.
Well, like, oh, well, good. You did it on one foot. Just hold. At this point, just hold. And it couldn't be like totally illegal because as long as land on one foot, maybe we will think about.
And she finishes her program with her back to the judges.
And, you know, usually you skate, you perform, you smile in front of the camera, boom, they give you the mark, next skater. For me, it took like 10 minutes, seriously, 10 minutes, people think about what should we do. I was like, happened? Oh my God, they didn't know what to do with me. And I said, whatever, just put a zero and so we can move on.
Here are the marks. Did she get nailed?
Absolutely. 4.8, 5.2. She knew. How do you get noticed in Olympic competition? Do a backflip.
So they didn't change their mind about the backflip in the end.
Nope.
So she ends up finishing 10th.
I was like, yeah, I finished 10th, but it's okay.
Now, afterwards, a lot of people interpreted that backflip as a big fat middle finger up to the entire skating world. I know you don't want me to, but I'm going to do this anyway. But when I asked Saria if that's what was happening, she said...
No. I don't know why people keep telling me that. You know, I was just trying to be happy.
She said she just wanted something that was hers.
Yes, yeah.
Had anyone ever done this backflip onto one blade before?
No. I'm the one who created this one. It's why it's called the Bonali.
Oh, that's so, called the Bonali?
Yeah. You know, I'm the only one who did it.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're the first person in the history of the human race who has done that.
Yeah. So knock on wood, I hope, you know, I'll be able to die in peace. Don't steal my backflip. It's mine.
I'll do my best.
but it's mine.
So I'm just curious, like, what has happened since this story ended?
Well, she retired from figure skating after the 98 Olympics. She continues to do ice shows occasionally. But right now, I think the main thing that she's doing is she's coaching. She lives in Minnesota, and she's coaching young skaters, yeah.
But like, when we asked people, like, oh, did she change the sport? Did she change figure skating? The answer they would keep giving to us was no, she didn't.
Yeah, a lot of people were like, it's not like all of a sudden, you know, figure skating rinks across the country, across the world, were flooded with little black girls learning their saokaos and their lutzes and things like that. I will say, from what I can tell, for the first time that there's more than one black skater competing at the same time, internationally at least.
What about backflips? Are there backflips everywhere?
No backflips, sadly.
Are they still illegal?
They're still illegal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yes. So she was just this sort of like almost this sort of blip on the skating scene where she was just, you know, no one was like her before. And there hasn't really been anyone like her since.
But there is this kind of ironic thing, I guess, which is that if you took her and you put her in competition today, if she was competing on the world stage today, she would probably do better than she did back then. They've changed the scoring system, so now you get points for doing the kinds of power moves that she was doing way back when. And even if you spill, even if you fail at those moves, you still get points.
You get points for trying.
Yeah, just for daring. And Saria was daring. She was a darer.
Producers Latif Nasser and Tracy Hunt. Tracy spent the last few months with us producing that story as part of the WNYC Fellows Program. Tracy, we will miss you a lot. The piece was produced by Matt Kielty. Original music from Matt and also from Dylan Keefe. Special thanks to Vanessa Riley, Moira North, skaters Aliza Anjali, and Christian Irwin from the Ice Theater of New York, and to Ed Haber for recording it all, and a very heartfelt thanks to Marilyn Wiggins. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thanks for listening.
Message.
Hi, Latif. This is Tanya calling.
Hi, this is Sandra Bezert.
I have no good news to Kenya. Radio Lab is produced by Jad Abumrad.
Dylan Keith is our director of sound design.
Soren Wheeler is senior editor.
Jamie York is our senior producer.
Our staff include
Simon Adler, Brenna Farrell, David Gable,
Matt Hilty, Robert Krulwich, and Damien.
Latif Nasser, Melissa O'Donnell, Kelsey Padgett,
Arian Wack, and Molly Webster. With help from Alexandra Lee Young,
Tracy Hunt, Stephanie Tam, and Micah Lowinger.
Our fact checkers are Eva Dasher and Michelle Harris. I wonder if you can hear the truck outside.
Hope that's okay.
And on behalf of everyone at the Radio Lab, thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
End of message.